This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Rice has written the lyrics to many of the most memorable tunes in contemporary musical theater, made more memorable by the fact that a lot of them made their way into mainstream popular music. He's written with Andrew Lloyd Webber. Think shows like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Jesus Christ Superstar, and Evita. For Chess, which contained the hit One Night in Bangkok, he teamed up with two members of ABBA. He collaborated with Elton John on music for The Lion King and a pop version of Verdi's Aida. And he joined composer Alan Menken to write lyrics for songs in Disney's Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. For those efforts, he's been given 3 Golden Globe Awards, 3 Oscars, 2 Tonys, and a Grammy. He's also been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. In 1994, Tim Rice was knighted by Queen Elizabeth, and recently Sir Tim was in Charlotte, a city to which he has ties, because of cricket. But that's a story for another day. He was here to help the British American Business Council Charlotte celebrate their 25th anniversary, and we sat down in front of a live audience at Charlotte Country Club to talk about his life, his career, lyric writing, and to hear some of his most popular songs performed live.
Everybody knows, I would assume almost everybody in this room knows all the shows that you've written lyrics for. How many different songs do you think you've written lyrics for?
It's probably in the region of 400 or 500, of which, frankly, only 20 are known, well-known anyway, and only, I would say, only about 100 are any good. I mean, I've got a lot of songs which... No, seriously, I'm not being modest, but everybody writes an awful lot of crap in order for the good stuff to come out. I've got a list of songs which I think are rather good, but nobody's quite heard. They've either been in the wrong show or they haven't had a good recording. And I probably could find 30 or 40 songs which in another universe could have been hits, and you know, but just weren't in the right place at the right time. But a lot of stuff one writes is not very good.
So what makes the difference? Do you know it when you write it, that that's not very good, so well, it'll be okay in this show, but
to a certain,
but this is a hit. This is a hit. How do you know that?
You don't always know, because certainly with, you know, the way I got going through shows rather than one-off songs.
Right.
I think it was, I mean, I Don't Know How to Love Him is a case in point. We wrote that for, it was a song in Jesus Christ Superstar, and it was a big hit out of the show as well as in the show. But originally it was a rather bad song called Kansas Morning, which the same beautiful tune with awful lyrics written by me.
And do you remember those lyrics?
Unfortunately, I do. But had that song only ever existed as Kansas Morning, it would be totally forgotten. But because it eventually had a good lyric, and more importantly, was in a good show, it became a hit.
So let me guess. La, Kansas Morning.
I love the Kansas morning. Kansas
You're right.
Mist at my window. You want to hear more?
It's terrible. Yeah,
but when it had a decent... It was interesting because I kind of thought this is in a way quite encouraging, because the tune was great. Andrew wrote a wonderful tune, but it wasn't a hit until it had a good lyric.
Uh-huh.
Both bits have to be good.
Right. I think the first show you collaborated on with Andrew Lloyd Webber was Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and that was followed up by Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm just curious, these are both biblically based.
Correct.
Why would you step out of the box?
We weren't trying to convert anybody or anything. It was, in fact, the first show we wrote, which never got off the ground, was a musical about Dr. Bernardo, the Victorian philanthropist, and that never got anywhere. I mean, it's a tragic story. It had some really good tunes. The music was good, and one or two of the tunes appeared in later shows.
Yeah.
And then we wrote Joseph for a school, and we chose, or I chose, the Bible story of Joseph because it was something, the only incentive we had was a schoolmaster commissioned it because he'd heard our Dr. Bernardo musical and he thought it was quite good. Nobody else had really heard it. But he said, write something for the kids. And the only carrot we had was that it would possibly be something that all schools would do, and it would be something that might become an educational staple for schools in years to come. So we thought, well, we better write something that appeals to teachers as well as to the kids. And that seemed to be Bible was pretty good. And Joseph was my favorite story when I was a child. I loved the story of Joseph, his coat of many colors. And it was a story we could have a few laughs with and be funny and also serious. And it worked. But it wasn't a hit initially. And it was that in turn led us to Superstar. And again, when I was a kid at school, I always thought Pontius Pilate and Judas Iscariot got a bit of a rough deal. I'm not saying they were nice guys, but Pontius Pilate happened to be there. He was governor of Judea at a time when this strange man was brought before him for trial. And Judas Iscariot was quite possibly the only, he was the most doubting member of the apostles who thought, I'm not sure where this movement's going. And these were things I thought about when I was at school. I went to a very church-based school, learnt the Bible stories, the New Testament, and I just thought, you know, what would it be like to be Judas Iscariot? Would I have been Judas, or would I have been Peter or Paul or whatever? Would I have been totally pro or doubting? And I think I would have been doubting.
When you look back at that show today, it seems very natural that it would be a hit, and it seems like everybody would be readily accepting of it. But I remember it started as a concept album.
Right.
And I remember first hearing it at my college radio station and being blown away by, A, the music on it and the idea of it, but also a little taken aback by the title, Jesus Christ, Superstar.
It was quite sort of wow in 1969. And originally, when we put out a record, the first single, which was just the song Superstar, we'd written the song Jesus Christ, Who Are You, What Have You Sacrificed? And that repeated. I saw an advert for Tom Jones, of all people, in a music paper, and it said, Tom Jones, the world's number one superstar. And I was just idly saying, Jesus Christ, Superstar. I thought, hang on, that kind of works. And I think that was a big factor in the success, because in 1969 or 1970, if you saw that album, you thought, this sounds interesting, or this sounds awful. But either way, you wanted to hear it, see what it was like. And I think the title was a big factor in getting people to listen to it. It had to be good. You know, people would listen to it, and if it was crap, they'd say, oh, forget it. But it was good. I can say this 40 years on. I'm not being arrogant. It's been a hit. I don't need to plug it. but if you haven't bought it, go out and get it. You can see. And it was the thing is, we didn't really know what we were doing, except we were doing what we liked. We were writing what we would have bought if somebody else had done it. And that title made a bit of a difference.
So did it have a script when you wanted to stage it, or did the script come later?
Had we staged it, I think it would have been pretty awful, and it would have lasted, it would have died. Mm-hmm. Because by mistake, we turned out to be groundbreaking with that album, but we hadn't intended to be. We thought this will be musical, and we'll have a book, and people, Judas will come in stage left and say, hi, Jesus, what's happening today? And then it would go into a song, and it would have been terrible, and we would have opened in a out-of-town theater in 1969, 1970, and in those days, you could not do rock in theater. There was no, it was impossible, really, for a theater to incorporate a rock band with musicians, and it was something that just didn't happen. The rock audience and the theater audience were way apart. And I think if we tried to do it as a stage show, it wouldn't have worked. And also, it wouldn't have been rock. We would have been toned down. They would have said, well, you can't do rock here, so we've got a nice little string quartet and this, that, and the other. But when we did it as an album, we had to make it more rock, which is what we wanted to do, because our only outlet for it was radio. Mm-hmm. So, and also, we had to make it shorter. We had two albums. We couldn't make it more than 80 minutes long. And the best thing about Superstar is that it's quite short. Most musicals are 10 minutes too long. Everything in life is 10 minutes too long, actually. So I'll stop this question.
So what was the interval between the concept album, which went on to success, and the first staging of it?
Well, it was weird because the album came out in England in September 1970, and it got a bit of an impact, but there was radio in those days. There was only the BBC. There was nothing else. There were no commercial radio stations. And BBC were a bit wary about playing it because they thought it might be blasphemous and all that. And it kind of flopped. But what we had, the Americans had said, MCA Records in America had said, well, come on over and do some promotion. And again, you've got to remember, in those days, there was no emails, there was no mobile phones. And we went and we thought, at least we're going to get a free trip to America. It'd be great fun. We'll see America. But when we turned up, the Americans had really, MCA had really thought this was going to be a hit. And they promoted it brilliantly. And it was like number 40 on the charts when we got to our hotel. It was number 20 the next morning and number 1 in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
It was extraordinary. It was overnight smash. It was such a big hit record. And then, of course, having had the situation before with nobody wanting to stage it as a show, suddenly everybody wanted to stage it. Because by mistake, we'd created a hit. We had a hit album and no theatre. And suddenly people thought, hang on, this isn't what My Fair Lady did. It's the wrong way round.
What was the biggest song in the show?
I Don't Know How to Love Him was the biggest song.
I Don't Know How to Love Him. And that's the song we're going to hear.
Great.
And we're going to bring back somebody who spent a lot of time in Charlotte, but who has gone on to great success, actually, in film and television. And I would like you all to welcome Maria Howell. I Don't Know How to Love Him. Lyrics by our guest, Tim Rice, from Jesus Christ Superstar. We'll have more of our conversation in just a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details on the Subaru Share the Love event at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. And Catawba Lands Conservancy supporting Giving Tuesday on November 28th, part of a global day of giving. Details on matching donations at #GivingTuesdayCLT or CatawbaLands.org. On the next Charlotte Talks, food crosses lines of race, class, and gender. It opens the door to a common language. On the biggest food holiday of the year, we'll talk about food and Southern cuisine in particular and what it says about who we are and where we come from. Then best-selling short story writer George Saunders talks about his award-winning novel. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9, here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, as families gather for Thanksgiving, we look at difficult conversations many will have about elder care, how to do it right and with love. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. You're listening to a conversation with lyricist Tim Rice in town for the British American Business Council's Charlotte's 25th anniversary dinner. We left off having just heard Maria Howell sing I Don't Know How to Love Him from Jesus Christ Superstar.
I saw people in the audience singing along, mouthing the words. That must be a great compliment to you. They know the words.
If they know it, yes, that's great. Yeah. I guess it is, yeah.
That song in the show is sung by Mary Magdalene.
Correct.
And it's about how she's never met a man like this before. She's singing about having been with lots of men, and this guy wants nothing to do with her in that way. But she loves him. How does she get through to him? How does he get through to her? How does that work, though, as a pop song? And it worked as a pop song.
I don't know. I mean, it was written for the storyline primarily, but I think any person entering into any love affair usually hasn't got a clue how it's going to go, and they worry about it. So it's a kind of what the hell's going on song, you know, which is what most people feel most of the time. Don't they?
You mentioned how these songs came into the popular consciousness before the show was even on the stage.
Yep.
Which is unusual because it's in the reverse, but it strikes me that since then your songs have taken the traditional path, but there was a period there after Rodgers and Hammerstein and Rodgers and Hart and George and Ira Gershwin and people like that, when those songs ceased to be the fodder for popular music, Broadway went away in the popular consciousness. Not your songs, not your shows. They keep leaking into radio and leaking into other venues. Why?
Well, I think obviously our stuff is more contemporary in one sense only than Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein, but their songs, which are absolutely brilliant, are still wildly popular. I mean, Rod Stewart, a Brit,
right,
recorded 5 albums of the Great American Songbook and sold millions of records. And those great songs don't go away. And I like to think that one or two of our songs have got up there with some of those songs. But our stuff, I mean, it's hard to get our sort of stuff played on the radio these days. You know, things have changed, and it's probably just because we're old codgers and a bit out of touch. But, you know, you can go on analysing why some things are successful and why some things aren't. And in the end, you just have to, something will strike a chord with the prospective buyer or listener. They will say, I think I understand that, or I think I... It could be just something that's got a great beat and it's fun, or it could be something that people think, I know, yeah, I've been in that situation, or my mum has been in that situation, or my friend's been, you know. It's just doing something that people can relate to. It doesn't have to be serious. It can be fun. Don't Step on My Blue Suede Shoes is a great lyric. It's a great song.
Yeah,
you know, and it just means sod off everybody. You know?
In 1981, you teamed up with two guys from ABBA, whose names I cannot pronounce. Benny Andersson, I can do.
Yep, Björn Ulvaeus.
To write what would become a show called Chess.
Right.
For people who have not seen this show, because it's not often done, but it too started as a concept album.
Yep.
What is Chess about?
Well, it's about, I was going to say cheap joke, 1 hour, 30 minutes. It's a Cold War love story set in 1979, and it's about a Russian chess player and an American chess player, and it's kind of based on Bobby Fischer and Korchnoi and Spassky and the Cold War. And it's difficult to talk about it without getting into, you know.
But is it also a metaphor for the fact that the Cold War was kind of a chess game?
Yeah, I mean, the Cold War back in the 70s and 80s was often fought by surrogate mm-hmm. Means. And when Fischer and Spassky met in Iceland for the World Chess Championship, Fischer was the American, and people like Henry Kissinger got involved because it was very important that they felt that the Americans must not lose to the Russians, and ditto on the Russian side. The complication there was that Fischer was meant to be our guy. It was a nasty piece of work. And Spassky, who was meant to be the evil representative of the ghastly communist regime, was actually a jolly nice fellow. So it was a bit confusing for people following it. But actually, it made rather a good point about the Cold War, that the Cold War, the people involved on either side, were not necessarily representative of what their nations felt. But I was intrigued by the complications, and I mean, Spassky wanted, he had love problems. Korchnoi, another Russian chess player, had left the East and couldn't get his wife and children out. I mean, there were so many personal, romantic, and tragic things that were involved in the story of these chess players and to the background of the Cold War.
But what an odd topic for a show. Whose idea was it?
Well, it was mine, I'm afraid. I do apologize. But
No.
But it's always been done. It was a big hit in London. The record was a big hit. We had a big single record called One Night in Bangkok mm-hmm. here from the score. And we had a number one record in England and other countries with a song called I Know Him So Well. And it was a big record. But it was a hit show in London, and it's been done in lots of other countries. But on Broadway, it was a total flop, a major disaster. But it wasn't a very good production, to be honest.
Okay. But when you got together...
It's coming back. Sorry about that.
But you got together with these two guys who had written Dancing Queen.
So, that's a good song.
It's a very good song. I'm not being pejorative. It's very good song, but it's very different from...
Well, if you listen to Benny Anderson's work... I would rate him up there with Grieg, as a Scandinavian wow. composer. He is phenomenal. And some of the stuff in chess is very classical.
Yes.
And if you listen to songs like The Winner Takes It All or Fernando, the melodies are just sensational. And ABBA only really broke over here quite late in their career. Mm. In Europe, the rest of the world, they were huge. They were as big as the Beatles in terms of their records, obviously not in terms of changing the culture, but... ABBA records just dominated the world. And they did it from Sweden. I mean, nobody thought that was possible. They won Eurovision, which is a competition for songs, which is regarded as a bit naff. And every year, somebody wins, and usually it's a pretty awful song. When they won, Waterloo went to number one. It was a big hit in America. And they conquered the world. This singing also, in English, they wouldn't have done it if they sung in Swedish.
You mentioned that some of the songs are kind of classical in nature, and one of them is called Anthem, and it is an anthem. In the show, it's an anthem.
Right.
It's an anthem to love. I think it's also a surrogate as an anthem for one of those countries.
Well, it's in the show, it's when the Russian chess player defects, and he's accused by the press of deserting his country, and he says, no, I'm not leaving anywhere, and he sings this song, the anthem, which is normally the end of the first half of the show.
So we're going to hear Anthem, which was written by you and these two guys from ABBA.
Right.
And then we're going to segue into another song that was written by one of the great talents of all time, in the rock era at least, Elton John, and you. And we're going to begin with Robert Nipper and Anthem.
And you ask me why I love her. Through wars, death, and despair, she is the constant. We who don't care, and you wonder, will I leave her? But how? I crossed over borders, but I'm still there
is Adam McKnight, and before that, Robert Nipper sang Anthem. And Circle of Life, of course, is from the great Disney hit, The Lion King. I expected lions and elephants to be walking through here, but instead everybody had their phones out, taping all of this. As that was being sung, I was just thinking, what must it be like to be somebody who writes lyrics I don't know how you do this or where you do it, but it's probably a very solitary thing. And then you get together with a composer, and they screw it up for you because it's your lyric. But then you hear it coming out of the mouths of these singers that bring it to life. What does that do for you the first time that you hear it, and then every other time that you hear it?
Well, the interesting thing about Circle of Life and other stuff with Elton is that he only writes music when he gets the lyrics. So, and that's unique with people I've worked with. 99% of composers prefer to write the tune and then hand it over to the lyricist. But when you're writing a show, be it words first or music first, you need to get the story right. So with Lion King, I was working with Disney on the story for quite a while before one felt able to send something to Elton. It was actually good for the project that Elton was going to add the music later because we were able to concentrate completely on the storyline. And we had two or three cracks at Circle of Life, which didn't really work. And then we decided to go for the slightly more serious approach to the song. Originally, it was going to be quite funny, with all songs about giraffes doing this, that, and the other. But then I thought, well, we need a fairly serious song, which kind of encapsulates the whole theme of the entire piece. And I sent this lyric off to... Actually, I didn't send it off to Elton. I said, I'll have the lyric by Tuesday because he was going to record it or write it on Thursday in the studio. And I rang him up and said, I'll get you. And he said, no, don't worry about that. Bring it along on Thursday. So I went along to the studio with the lyric, which I'd just finished in time, and gave it to Elton. And he sat there in the studio. It's one of the most extraordinary moments of my entire working life. And he sat there with a guy called Guy, funny enough, Guy Babylon, who was his sort of technical musician. He would do all the rhythms and set up any patterns Elton wanted. And Elton got various rhythms going, and he sat at the keyboard. And I gave him the lyric, and he began singing it. And we just sat there in the control room listening to him singing these words over and over again. And gradually a tune was emerging. And at one point he said, can I have one more line? Because he was building up this fantastic crescendo, you know, leap of faith or whatever. I can't remember the words now, but it went right up, you know, building up to this climax. And he wanted another line, and I just said, on the path unwinding. I'm not quite sure where that came from, probably from Nick from Long and Winding Road. but it kind of worked. And he wrote the entire beautiful melody in an hour and a half, and that was quite wow. Something. And then he said, well, here it is. I thought, well, this sounds like a hit to me.
Just another hit for each of them. We have more of our conversation with Golden Globe, Oscar, Tony, and Grammy-winning lyricist Tim Rice in a moment, and another live performance which had most of the audience mouthing the words. You probably will, too, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hefner Financial of Charlotte. Jim Hefner is an independent fiduciary financial planner whose team specializes in retirement solutions and tax strategies. Information at youlljustknow.com. And Northeast Digestive Health Center, the practice has expanded to help support the growing community. A second location at Edison Square in Concord is now open and ready to serve patients' GI needs. More info at northeastdigestive.com. Coming up in 20 minutes on On Point at 10 o'clock, as families gather for Thanksgiving this week, guest host Anthony Brooks and a panel of experts look at difficult conversations many will have about elder care, how to do it right and with love. That's On Point in 20 minutes at 10 on 90.7 WFAE. If you're enjoying today's edition of Charlotte Talks, you can hear more on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We have a bonus segment of the show with music from Aladdin. We'll be right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Robert Mugabe has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980, and now his reign may have come to an end.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The large maximum security prisons in North Carolina, you could have a 30% officer vacancy rate.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening to my conversation with world-renowned lyricist Tim Rice at the 25th British American Business Council Charlotte Dinner. His work with Andrew Lloyd Webber on Jesus Christ Superstar put the pair on the map, and that came after they both collaborated on Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The two went on to work together on Evita. Later, he would collaborate with Elton John on two musicals, including The Lion King. He's also put his stamp on Disney's Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast. Tim Rice's lyrics tell memorable stories in a memorable way, and his contributions to musical theater put him among the most important contributors to the form. Many of his songs have been able to do something rare, break out of the theater and onto the radio and become pop hits on their own. That probably owes much to Tim Rice's own fascination with pop music. Early in his career, he was in a band, and he's written standalone songs for individual artists since. It's one thing to create a song. It's another to hear it sung for the first time. What must that be like? So I asked him.
So you never answered my question about what it must be like for you as a lyricist to first hear these songs that you've written come to life.
Well, I suppose if it's good, it's great. I mean, the interesting thing is that other things, like Don't Cry For Me Argentina, for example, I got the tune first, and I would then have to put a lyric to the tune. Right. So when I'd done that, I was the only person in the world who'd heard the song, the finished song. And you don't really know whether it's any good until somebody else hears it. With the other way around, when I'm writing the words without a tune, and it comes back to me, then that is when you feel the wow, right. The wow factor.
Which way do you like working? Do you like
I think it... I mean, honestly, it's hard to choose. It was good for my stuff with Disney, with Elton. It was a different way of working, and I rather liked that. Mm. I was doing the same job, but I was working in a way I hadn't done before, so it kind of got me enthused and a spark of greater enthusiasm, perhaps.
But when you're writing a set of lyrics for a show like Evita and for somebody like Andrew Lloyd Webber, it must be different than writing with Elton John. It must be very different.
It's very different. I mean, Andrew is much more theatrical, traditional theatre than Elton. And he didn't really want to do Evita in the first instance. I had to persuade him this was a good idea. And I think he wrote a magnificent score, partly because I don't think he thought it would be a hit. I really think he thought, well, I'm not quite sure what I want to do at the moment, but I'll do Tim's bonkers idea on this Eva Peron lady. And he wrote a wonderful score. And it was, I mean, I saw Evita in London. It came back to London last summer, and I saw it again for the first time in a theatre for a couple of years. And I just kept thinking, these are great tunes. I mean, there isn't a bad tune in it. It's tune after tune after tune, and it's a magnificent score.
Yeah, I think.
Don't think Andrew was thinking about how do I promote this, you know, how do I sell this, what theatre will I put it in. That was not. He was young, and he just thought, I'll do this while I'm thinking about what to do next.
I think when, this is my opinion, and I could be really wrong, but I think that when the history of the American or of musicals of the 20th and 21st century is written, it's going to be, aside from the Gershwins and people like that, it's going to be Stephen Sondheim, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Timothy Rice, and the Disney musicals, which have just taken, they've changed the face of Broadway. And a lot of people take objection to that because they say it's the Disneyfication of an art form, and it's kind of ruined it. I don't think it has. What do you think?
Well, I think it's Disney, like anybody else, some of the shows are great and some of them are not so great. And I wouldn't, you know, certainly not publicly say which ones I think are great and which ones aren't. But I think...
Oh, come
you
know, on. No one's listening.
But everybody, you know, certainly me and Andrew included, we've had disasters. And the Disney team are really good and most of their stuff's been successful. But I think when they do something like Lion King or Beauty and the Beast, there's no doubt that it is a great asset to musical theatre history, if you like. And no one can have a smash all the time. I mean, Stephen Sondheim's had a few flops.
Oh, yeah.
And Andrew and I certainly have. So it's...
But when you start...
Nobody knows, and when you're working on a show, nobody knows really until it's too late whether it's going to be a hit or not.
When you start your career with writing something like Jesus Christ Superstar, which was cutting edge for its time,
yep,
and rock in a world that wasn't open to having rock music played in a pit band or on the stage, and then you move toward your later parts of your career to writing Disney stuff, and the songs you've written are wonderful, but do they seem tame to you in retrospect?
Oh, difficult question. After Andrew and I parted our ways and he went on to do Phantom and Cats, I did Chess, which I feel was cutting edge. Mm-hmm. It's still around, and it was definitely quite contemporary. I don't know. You see, I think Lion King, which I saw last week in New York, when you look at it, you think, actually, this is quite a breakthrough in many ways. But there's nothing wrong, actually, in being part of the conventional, family tree of musicals. And you can't, frankly, when you get on a bit, when you're, not 28 anymore, it's difficult to be cutting edge, I can assure you.
The Lion King, you mentioned
seeing... Have my moments, though.
You mentioned seeing Lion King last week, and you saw it, was it last week, 2 weeks ago?
Yep.
Because it celebrated a milestone.
It did 20 years on Broadway, yeah.
20 years on Broadway.
Still 7 years. Don't get carried away.
Where do you put the royalty checks? That's what I want.
I'm very, very grateful for that. It's an old age pension, to put it mildly. But the thing is, shows are running much longer now. I mean, 20 years is phenomenal, but it's not incredibly phenomenal, if that's not an oxymoron. It's Phantom's done 27 years, Les Mis did 24 or something. Shows run much, much longer. My Fair Lady, one of the greatest shows ever written, ran about 4 years, and that was phenomenal. Superstar, in its day in London, and it was a big hit, broke the all-time record for a long run, 8 years. Well, 8 years now is almost a flop. You know, there's extraordinary, huge new audiences, despite the fact that the shows go out everywhere. They go to Budapest, they go to Stockholm, they go to all over America, they go around the world, Australia, Japan, Korea. Despite that, you can go and see Lion King almost anywhere. It still runs for 20 years on Broadway. I'm quite sure I understand why.
To make the money back.
Well, no, but of course, but you can't, even Disney can't force people into the theatre.
Well, it's because
of
people...
Disney have had flops.
But it's because of people like you and shows that you've been involved in that really has revitalized the musical. The musical was kind of dead. When Jesus Christ Superstar came along, there was all this panic in New York about, this new...
Well, I think the musical is always written off every sort of 3 or 4 years. People say, it's not what it was. And in a way, they're right, but in a way, they're also wrong, because people will look back on in 2040, they'll say, Les Mis, Miss Saigon, Phantom, Cats, Evita, that was a pretty good era. What's wrong with the guys now? And whoever's writing hit musicals in 2030 and 2040, they'll be slagged off, and then in 2070, they'll be looked back as a golden age. You know, it's by and large, I think musicals keep going somehow, and they're incredibly popular still.
Yeah.
I mean, they work. And I mean, look at Hamilton, what a great show. Hamilton is brilliant. I mean, Hamilton is, in a way, the superstar of its day, you know, without trying to make superstars sound terrific, but it's different, and it's proven that you can do something different. And the great thing about Hamilton is it's not only got very modern music, it could only have been written in the last few years. It also sticks to musical tradition by telling a great story with wonderful choreography and great sets and lighting. It's a great, I mean, I'm sure some of you have seen it. It's a fantastically good show. A bit worrying, really.
I understand that maybe it's not your latest work anymore, but there was a period in the not-too-distant past when you were working on the musical version of From Here to Eternity.
Well, I am, yes. That's very much...
It's been produced.
It's been produced. I've just come down from Maine, where it was done at the Ogunquit Playhouse, and it worked very well. And it's just such a good story. The great James Jones book. It's all set in Pearl Harbor. Well, not all in Pearl Harbor, but it's all set in Hawaii just before the Pearl Harbor attack.
How does somebody who has not had enormous success get to work with Tim Rice?
Well, I've just known him for 20 years, and he writes about 3 musicals a week, And he's just very great fan of musicals. He had a pop group for a while, which did quite well. And he just sent me musical after musical. And when he sent me From Here to Eternity, I thought, this is interesting. And it was such a good story. And it may well get to Broadway. It may not, but so far it's just making the progress slowly but surely.
Well, I've seen little snippets of it, and it looks terrific.
There's some good stuff in it, I think. But
I was told under strict orders to keep this to 55 minutes,
right. And
we're coming up toward that. So to end the evening, may I return to the beginning?
To the beginning, yes.
and to Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You wrote a song for that show, in which I think encapsulates the message for the show, and which tells the audience to believe in their own dreams.
Yes, it's a funny song. Any dream will do. Assuming that's the one you're going to
play.
That's
the song.
Otherwise, what I'm about to say is a complete waste of time. It's a funny song because it's actually rather... It's a bit pessimistic. I look at it and I think, ooh. It's sort of assumed to be a happy song, and it's always sung when Joseph comes on. He sings it like he's terribly happy. And in a way it is, but it's kind of... The message is really... Most people would rather dream than face reality, which is not a particularly cheerful message, although I think that's often true. Yet it somehow comes over, because it's got such a lovely, catchy tune, it comes over as a very positive song, which I hope it is a positive song, but I have to say, sometimes I think the lyrics are a little bit of a downer. I get lots of people writing to me saying, what does this song mean? And I say, well, it's about people who... go to sleep, or they dream. Men don't go to sleep, but they dream and they have ambitions and everything's wonderful. And then something goes wrong and they want to get back to the dream. But I'm not saying that things have to go wrong. I bored the hell out of you on this song. It was sort of, you know, you probably liked the song until now, but...
I kind of did.
But it's... every time I hear it, and when you go to see Joseph, you will hear it several times... Every time I hear it, I think it's one of the most popular songs we've ever written. I mean, in England, you can't get away from it. And I saw Joseph the other day in London, and, you know, everybody loves that song. They go bananas about it.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't think any of you get it. And I think, I wish I'd written a slightly more up lyric. But
it's never
if people
too late.
Think it's an up lyric, then that's fine. I hope they do.
Okay, we're going to bring everybody back on this one. Maria Howell, Adam McKnight, Robert Nipper all singing, along with Noel Friedland at piano, Tim Singh on bass, and Al Sergel
it's a great
on
song.
Drums. Any dream will do.
I close my eyes, drew back the curtain, to see for certain what I thought I knew. Far, far away, someone was weeping, but the world was sleeping. Any dream will do.
I wore my coat,
I wore my coat
with gold. Bright color shining, wonderful and new.
And in the east,
the dawn was breaking, and the world was waking. Any dream will do.
A crash of drums, a flash of light, my golden coat.
The I return.
May I return
to the beginning.
Ah,
the light is dimming.
Ah,
and the dream is too. The world and I.
The world and I.
We are still waiting.
Ah,
still hesitating.
Ah,
any dream will do.
Maria Howell, Anna McKnight, Robert Nipper, the lyrics of Tim Rice.
Thank you.
Lyricist Tim Rice recorded recently at a dinner at Charlotte Country Club for the British American Business Council Charlotte's 25th anniversary celebration. I'm Mike Collins.